Good morning. This is Dr. Verdi, and you're listening to WPKN 89.5 FM. We serve Fairfield, New Haven, Litchfield counties in Connecticut and Suffolk County in New York, as well as communities all around the world. This information is purely for educational purposes. If you want to make any changes to your health routine or the health routine of a loved one, please discuss it with a licensed healthcare practitioner first. Because although the medicine I practice is natural, it's still medicine. So it requires very skillful use. So with all of that said, in the past decade, I've lived in a handful of different states, and some of you listeners may be aware that I'm moving back to my home state in Maryland. In spite of the move, I'm going to continue to come up here to see my patients, and I'm going to continue with the radio show month to month, but I have decided to add a co-host, Dr. Jennifer Pierre. And she's going to be calling in later. I would love to give our listeners an introduction, and she's going to share a few tidbits for staying healthy through the summer as well. So from living in Connecticut over the past couple of years, what I've noticed is that Connecticut is the only state I've lived in where discussing weather is not considered small talk. It seems to be a deeply personal subject, especially in the winter months, about overcoming challenging times. Recently, with the tornado that hit down, there was a lot of discussion about unpredictability, and it seems as if people explore the changes that they notice within themselves and their lives alongside changes in weather. So I hear this a lot in my office. Usually in the winter months, people stop feeling motivated to eat healthy or exercise. And as soon as the sun starts coming out and our days get longer, people want to eat lighter meals and go out for walks and jogs. I'll hear a lot about allergy symptoms. So when the trees, for example, are blooming, I'll have patients come in with fatigue or headaches. And we all seem to be linked through our experience of weather and how it affects our health. So it turns out that summer has a really big physiological effect on our body, starting with our DNA. So our bodies literally change our genetic expression from winter months to summer months. So when genetic expression changes, that means that literally all of the proteins and the structure and the hormones, the neurotransmitters, everything in our bodies are different. And I hear patients say that they just feel better in the summer compared to winter months. And when you look at it within this context of how our body composition is literally changing, it makes sense that we would feel a noticeable difference. Almost 1/4 of our genes change depending on the season that we're in. And this seasonal change affects our immune cells. It affects what's circulating in our blood. So we see changes in cholesterol levels where they come down in the summertime and they go back up in the wintertime. We even see changes in how fat is deposited in our bodies, which makes sense because wintertime was a time when we didn't have access to a lot of food historically. So we would want to be able to store a lot of our calories as fat instead of burning through them like we would in the summer when we are surrounded by edible foods and animals are in abundance. So the seasonal variation provides a explanation for why we see seasonal variation in diseases like cardiovascular disease, autoimmune disease, diabetes, multiple sclerosis, many more conditions we see seasonal variation. So there's one specific gene that's more active in the summertime. It's called ARNTL. And this gene suppresses inflammation in our bodies. So we have lower levels of inflammation in the summertime. Now, this makes sense because wintertime is when we are more challenged by infections. So first, we live in closer quarters to people, so we're more likely to be exposed to diseases. Diseases are able to travel easier because of the change in air temperature. We become more vulnerable to developing infections because of the change in air temperature. And inflammation is our body's way of signaling to our immune system that we have something that we need to fix. It's almost like the ambulance that signals that we have to go to a certain part of the body and overcome an infection or overcome an injury. So it makes sense that in the summertime we would have higher levels of inflammation, or in the wintertime we would have higher levels of inflammation, since we're more prone to potentially developing illness. So the second thing is heat. So how heat affects us. It takes about 2 weeks for us to adjust to changes in our temperature. And the adjusting is called acclimatization. And this happens quicker if people spend more time outside, exposing their bodies to outside air temperature. So right now, a lot of us spend our time indoors. And as soon as it gets hot outside, a lot of people end up turning on the air conditioning. The air conditioning at work, for example, is turned on and on full blast. So we are not really able to give our bodies a chance to adapt. One way that we can help our bodies adapt is by first trying to spend more time outside when it gets warmer. Again, it takes around 2 weeks, so just spending a couple of hours outside will help your body adjust to the changes in temperature. A lot of people notice that they become more fatigued in the first week or two of weather change, and eventually your body is able to adjust to those changes. I wanted to bring up how funny it is that today's show is about summertime. I had been anticipating 80 degree weather this morning with the sun out, and it feels like we're back in fall. It's cold and rainy. So save all of the tidbits that I'm sharing with you today for when it gets warmer out. Hopefully that will be next week. So there are other factors that that help to determine how quickly we will adjust to changes in temperature. First is our age. So the younger people are, the easier it is for them to adapt to temperature changes. It seems like the elderly have a harder time adjusting to temperature changes. Lean individuals are less sensitive to heat compared to overweight and obese individuals. And this has everything to do with the surface area to mass ratio. So if there is a larger surface area to mass ratio, it means that there's more surface area on our skin that allows us to cool off through sweating and evaporation. When people have a larger mass and a smaller amount of surface area, they're not able to cool off as quickly. So leaner individuals typically will find it easier to experience hot weather, and they'll be able to cool off a lot quicker. So one suggestion is to set your temperature in your house 5 to 10 degrees below what it is outside to help you adjust to the heat if you're struggling with it. Many people just try not to use the air conditioning at all, and they open up their windows at night to help the cool air come in. So, speaking of air conditioning, did you know that men and women are comfortable at different levels of cold coming from the air conditioning? So I think this is very validating information for women especially. Having lived in Arizona for 5 years, I noticed that it was almost impossible to wear the right outfit on any given day. And it's because it would be scorching hot outside, but when you would go into buildings, it would be 65 degrees. It would be freezing cold. So I noticed that you always had to wear layers and dress for both summer and winter, and I'm sure other listeners have noticed that. You could be wearing a completely comfortable outfit for being outside, but as soon as you go into your workplace, you're freezing cold. And this is because the standards for where we should set a thermostat is based on the male metabolism. Actually, specifically, the metabolism of a 40-year-old man. And so this is why women are often freezing cold at work. I think it also has to do with the fact that women have way more clothing options to stay cool in the summertime, where it seems like men are usually stuck wearing slacks and a long sleeve shirt, or maybe a short sleeve polo if they're lucky. So women, we have more options to cool off, but the typical workplace, the temperature setting is around 70 degrees, which is freezing cold for women. Women typically feel more comfortable at around 77 degrees. So the reason why men are more comfortable at lower temperatures is because they have a quicker metabolism. So they have a higher basal metabolic rate, which means that they produce more heat in their bodies compared to women. What I will bring up, though, is that women, based on where we're at in our menstrual cycle, if we're cycling, we also have different basal metabolic rates. So in the first phase of the cycle, the follicular phase, day one of the cycle until ovulation, we are typically colder. As soon as ovulation hits, when we have a peak in progesterone, we become warmer. So this might be why, ladies, some of you may notice that sometimes you're freezing cold and other times you're sweating and your partner may be cold. It's because your metabolism changes. And so a lot of women notice that based on where they're at in their cycle, their workouts, their ability to do high endurance exercise or cardiovascular exercise varies based on where their basal metabolic rate is. So if you're just tuning in now, I'm Dr. Verdi. You're listening to Seeking Wellness Radio, Our Bodies Explained. We are discussing health in the summer months, which I thought we had finally achieved summer here in Connecticut, but we have time traveled back to fall. But this show is all about how to stay healthy through the summer months. There is some risk to using air conditioning. And I'm sure a lot of you listeners have heard about the phrase sick building syndrome. So sick building syndrome happens when poorly maintained air conditioning units cause people to get sick. Typically, it's because contaminants like bacteria and fungus are growing. And so people will have general symptoms of being unwell. They'll notice headaches, fatigue, breathing problems, skin rashes, allergies. They'll notice these vague symptoms and they won't really be able to pinpoint exactly where it's coming from and whether it's abnormal for them or not until it gets really bad. So I've had a few patients who developed full-on anaphylaxis, which is a full-body allergic reaction, can lead to death. So that was a reaction that definitely signaled to that person there's something growing in the air conditioning in this building. They were able to remediate the situation and she was fine. But a lot of people have really subtle symptoms, and so they're unaware that their air conditioner may be making them sick. So if you notice that you get sick in the summertime, if you notice that you feel more sick when it's hot out and you're working, or if you only get symptoms in one location, so say you go away on vacation and you're not sick, and then you come back to work and you're suddenly sick, or you're never sick when you leave your house to visit family, but when you come home, you notice you're sick, that might be a signal that there's something in your environment making you sick. And air conditioners are definitely can be the culprit for some people, especially if they notice they're getting sick in the summertime. So what about non-air conditioning ways to stay cool? Have you ever wondered why hot countries have such spice-loving palates? For example, you could find any Punjabi Indian, which I'm a Punjabi Indian, so you could find any Punjabi Indian enjoying a cup of hot chai tea. Not iced, hot chai tea in the summertime. It could be 98 degrees outside and you'll find us drinking a cup of hot chai tea. Or if you've ever had Mexican or Indian or Ethiopian cuisine, prepared the traditional way, there are really hot spices in the food. And it almost seems counterintuitive that a lot of cultures rely on hot foods and spicy foods to stay cool, but there's a scientific mechanism behind it. So physically hot foods cause blood to reach our surface skin, whereas cold causes our blood to kind of go into our core, to leave the surface of our skin and go to our core. So when we're drinking hot foods, our blood vessels on the surface dilate, our face will get red, for example, and we'll start to sweat around our face and on our bodies. And that sweating, as the sweat is evaporating off of us, our core temperature comes down. And when you're eating spicy food, again, we have an increase in internal temperature, and that's because our taste receptors are interpreting that we're eating something spicy, and we start to sweat. And as we sweat, our internal temperature initially goes up, but then the sweating causes it to go down. So if you took two people and they were in the same temperature, the same environment, and one had cold water and the other one had hot, okay, so one person had an iced chai tea is the example I'll use. The other person had a hot chai tea. After consuming the tea, the person who had the hot chai tea will initially have a higher body temperature, feeling hotter. But over the next couple of hours, their body temperature will actually be lower than the person who had the cold beverage. And the same goes for spicy foods, where if somebody ate a mild meal and somebody ate a spicy meal, initially, the person who ate the mild meal will feel more comfortable. Their body, internal body temperature will be lower than the person who ate the spicy meal. But once the person who ate the spicy meal is able to sweat and release that heat, they end up having a lower core body temperature. So that is one way that you can adjust to changes in our weather, is actually by changing the foods that you're eating, which back before we had air conditioning, we relied heavily on diet and natural means to stay cool. So it makes sense to me that our ancestors discovered that spicy food is helpful in the summertime. So something else that we see a lot of in the summer months is coconut water. So I'm not sure if you guys, you listeners, have been out grocery shopping and you've noticed that there's sales on coconut water, and coconut water just seems to be touted as a natural way to replenish our electrolytes, almost like a natural Gatorade or energy drink. And it's becoming more popular, especially as we're learning more about the detrimental effects of soda and juices on our metabolisms. Here in the U.S., our rate of diabetes is about 1 out of 3 people is either a diabetic or pre-diabetic. So it's epidemic. So it makes sense that we would be looking for alternatives to juices and sodas, which tend to be the drinks that have higher levels of soda and high fructose corn syrup. Coconut water is good. It has a lot of potassium and magnesium, which are important electrolytes for hydration, but it has really high levels of naturally occurring sugars. So if people are going to drink coconut water, I would recommend either diluting it in a lot of plain water or having it sparingly. And instead, get your electrolytes from food sources. So avocados and bananas, for example, are really high in potassium. My parents grew up in Kenya, where it was really hot in the summertime. And they had habits that I grew up watching. And one thing I noticed was in the summertime, my dad in particular would flavor his water with a squeeze of lime juice and a pinch of salt. And that was his thing. He would come upstairs and have a glass of lime water with a pinch of salt. And in India, there's a drink called lassi, which is a yogurt water drink. So it's similar to kefir. It's almost like, if I'm remembering correctly, the way that we would prepare it was we would literally take yogurt and water it down And if you go to Indian restaurants, you'll see that it's usually sweetened with sugar or flavored with mango. But at my temple where I grew up, we rarely sweetened it. Almost always, it was enjoyed with a pinch of salt. So the salt is because we need to replenish our electrolytes if we've been sweating a lot. So it turns out that this cultural habit of not sweetening things with sugar and instead salting things. Oh, another example is mangoes. So a lot of Punjabi Indians will salt their mangoes and then eat them. And again, that's a way of making sure you're getting your electrolytes. Fruits tend to have a lot of potassium and magnesium. If you're adding a pinch of salt, you're also going to get the sodium that helps replenish your electrolytes. There are specific foods that are really good to have in the summertime. And if you listened into the hydration episode of Seeking Wellness, this will sound familiar. So watermelon and cucumber in particular are really good fruits. Cucumbers are technically a fruit, but they are also considered a vegetable. So they're really healthy plant-based ways of increasing our electrolytes, getting more antioxidants, but also staying hydrated without needing to drink water. So those are some tidbits to staying cool through the summer months. Unfortunately, we can't implement them today since it's freezing outside. But if you're just tuning in now, I'm Dr. Verdi. You're listening to Seeking Wellness Radio, Our Bodies Explained. The next topic is going to be vitamin D. We often think that summertime is the best time to get vitamin D because we're in the sun more. And our bodies synthesize vitamin D through our skin. But there's actually a very specific time of day that we need to be out in the sun for to produce vitamin D. And it's typically between 11 and 1 p.m. And that's because at that time, the sun is allowing wavelengths between 290 and 320 nms to cross through our atmosphere and hit our skin. And it's UVB rays that are at that length that activate vitamin D production. During this time that you're in the sun, it's recommended not to wear any lotions or sunscreen that would end up blocking the sun's rays. Winter months, in spite of trying to be out when the sun is out, winter months will not improve vitamin D levels in spite of exposure to the sun. And that's because we don't have the UVB passing through our atmosphere at the lengths that we need it to. And this is because of the angle that the sun is hitting, hitting us in the wintertime. So in order for our bodies to produce vitamin D from sunlight, we need to be in the sun without sunscreen. And actually, fair-skinned people are able to produce vitamin D from UVB rays much quicker than darker-skinned individuals. And it can be an extreme variation where very fair people only need to be in the skin for 10 minutes as opposed to darker-skinned people who need to be in the sun for a few hours. So for myself, I'm dark, and I get darker the more time I spend in the sun. And when I lived in Arizona, I went on a really long camping trip all around northern Arizona and Utah in the summertime. So I spent a lot of time in the sunlight. I wasn't wearing sunscreen. It took about 10 days of hiking in the sun for me to finally get my first sunburn, and it was just confined to my nose. So my body is able to adjust to sun exposure very quickly, and but it also means, though, that it takes more sunlight exposure for my body to produce vitamin D. The Vitamin D Council recommends that in order to produce vitamin D, you spend half the amount of time it takes you to burn in the sun without any sunscreen. So for me, based on the fact that it took me about 10 days to have a burn, I would need to spend a lot of time in the sunlight, as opposed to people who burn within 2 hours of being in the sunlight. They may only need to be in the sun for 15 or 30 minutes. So it's variable based on your skin tone. And the amount of melanin in your skin affects how much vitamin D you're able to produce. So melanin is the substance that provides pigment in our skin. And individuals who have darker complexions have more melanin. And the melanin will actually absorb UVB rays to prevent damage from the sun. So we talked about how vitamin D depends on the time of day that you're in the sun, where you live in the world, and the season, and then also the color of your skin is dependent on vitamin D production. The increase in sunlight, so especially for people who are prone to burning, the increase in sunlight means that we're probably also slathering on sunscreen, especially if you're prone to burning or you have a family history of skin cancer. It's important to protect your skin. But it turns out that a lot of sunscreen that's on the market may not actually be beneficial for our health. But one other thing I wanted to bring up is air pollution. So air pollution can actually reflect UVB rays back away from the earth as it's traveling through our atmosphere. And this means that heavily polluted areas will have lower levels of UVB that will hit our skin and allow us to produce vitamin D. So the other thing that would happen when I lived in Arizona was people would come in, construction workers, people who were outside all the time would come in and I would test their vitamin D levels and it would be 17. We like to see it above 30. Anything under 30 is considered a deficiency of vitamin D. So we would try to explain the fact that you need to be out in the sun at a certain time. You need to expose your skin. The more skin you expose, the more vitamin D you're able to produce. But I actually didn't know that air pollution could impact UVB light. And Phoenix is a very polluted city, which is why we have gorgeous sunsets there. But it's probably also why everybody is vitamin D deficient in spite of spending a lot of time outside. Even being behind glass will block UVB light. So in order to produce vitamin D, you want to try to expose as much skin, be out between 10 and 1 during the daytime, and be out for roughly half the amount of time it takes you to get burned. Now, everybody's unique, so I would definitely recommend talking to your dermatologist if you have a history of sunburn, any precancerous or cancerous lesions, or if you have a family history of skin cancer. The main recommendation I have for skin protection is actually covering your skin with clothing, and wearing hats and sunglasses seem to be the safest way to protect your skin. And this is because research has shown that sunscreen can help prevent squamous cell carcinoma. It doesn't really have an effect in preventing basal cell carcinoma. Basal cell is the kind of cancer that grows very slowly. But melanoma, which is one of the most deadly forms of skin cancer, the research is showing contradictory information regarding sunscreen. So some research shows that sunscreen prevents melanoma, while others show that wearing sunscreen can increase your chance of melanoma. Now, why is this? It's probably because of the chemicals that we find in a lot of sunscreens. So the sunscreens are made of a couple of different chemicals. There's inorganic and organic sunscreen. Inorganic chemicals are zinc oxide, titanium oxide. They're what have been known to turn our skin white. So if you've ever seen pictures of people, for example, sunbathing in the 1970s, and you see there's white on their nose and their cheeks, that is zinc oxide and titanium oxide. These inorganic chemicals scatter the sun rays away from our skin, while organic chemicals absorb the sun's rays before our skin can. So oxybenzone, for example. Now, people with darker pigmented skin, we have the extra melanin. So our melanin absorbs the sun's rays before it can cause damage in our skin cells itself. UVB rays are associated with skin burns and increase our risk of cancer, while UVA rays cause wrinkling and increase the aging process of our skin. So because some UV radiation still gets through the sunscreen and into your skin, the SPF number refers to how long it will take for a person's skin to turn red. So a sunscreen with SPF 15 will prevent your skin from turning red approximately 15 times longer than you would usually take to turn red. So it's usually recommended to reapply sunscreen every 15 to 30 minutes. So I often bring up, if you've been listening for a while now, I often bring up the Environmental Working Group because I love them so much. They're an organization that really advocates for our health and the health of consumers in our country, where they want to make the consumers aware of the chemicals that are growing in our products, the pesticides that are in our food sources. And they have done studies on sunscreens, and they found that many sunscreens on the market do not provide adequate protection from the sun, or they contain harmful chemicals that can lead to precancerous changes. So I think the big confusion about sunscreen stems from the fact that the FDA has yet to offer an official set of safety standards for sunscreens, and in today's episode, I'm going to go over some things to look out for. So one thing is that sunscreen may be providing people with a false sense of being protected, so they spend more time than their bodies can handle in the sun. The UVA and UVB radiation will cause oxidative changes in our skin that will literally penetrate into our cells, into our DNA, and cause changes in our DNA, which is where we see the precancerous effects. The Environmental Working Group recommends avoiding any sunscreens that contain harmful chemicals that can easily penetrate the skin, such as oxybenzone. That one's been known as a main offender and has been found to cause DNA damage in the presence of sunlight. And a couple of studies have found an increased risk of malignant melanoma from using sunscreens like that contain oxybenzone. Titanium dioxide is a partial blocker against UVA and UVB rays, while zinc oxide offers full protection. Now, you also have to be aware of the types of oils that are in your sunscreen. If you have polyunsaturated fats like almond oil, canola oil, or if you have vitamin A, there's also a risk of burning from the oils oxidizing. So one thing that we often don't talk about, though, is the importance of our diet on our skin health, especially in the summertime. When radiation hits our skin, it leads to that oxidative damage that I was talking about, and that oxidative damage is what leads to precancerous changes. And it's interesting because in the summertime when the sun is out, oftentimes we are barbecuing, and if you're an adult, often you're consuming alcohol if you're out on the beach or at a party. And both charred food, so barbecued food, and alcohol are known for their ability to lower our antioxidant levels and known to lead to precancerous changes. Alcohol is literally a toxin in our body, so we need to be able to have our liver filter and metabolize the alcohol out of our bloodstream. So in general, when we're out in the sun, oftentimes we're eating foods that are leading to more oxidative damage. Whereas a lot of studies have found that if you're out in the sun and you're eating high antioxidant foods, for example, fruits and vegetables like blueberries and spinach, that food, the antioxidants in those plants actually reach our bloodstream and protect our skin from damage. So I've done this test before where I've gone to the beach with a group of friends and I've bought a huge tub of blueberries and asked half of my friends to eat the blueberries, the other half not to, just to see, just as like a game to see is there a noticeable difference? And my friends who ate blueberries noticed that they didn't burn as readily as they would have otherwise. So we definitely have to consider our diet as part of our sun protection. And you have to wonder, why is it that in the summertime, things like berries are growing in abundance, and melons and greens, a lot of high antioxidant foods? It may be because it's offering us protection from the sun. Antioxidants stabilize the reactive oxygen species, which are the precancerous chemicals that are formed when we are exposed to the sun's rays. And researchers found that people with higher levels of sun exposure and lower levels of circulating antioxidants were four times more likely to develop macular degeneration, age-related macular degeneration, which is a retina-related disease where people lose central vision. And in the case of age-related, it's often due to sun exposure and low antioxidant status. Photoaging of the skin, it's typically found in people who have lower levels of melanin, because the melanin is what protects us. And it's been found that people who have higher levels of antioxidants like glutathione, superoxide dismutase, and nutrients that help to recycle our antioxidants, enzymes like vitamin E, vitamin C, CoQ10, vitamin E, all of those micronutrients have been found to protect our skin from the harmful effects of radiation. Specifically, there was one study done on mice, and they found that mice who had high levels of antioxidants after being exposed to UV light had a reduction in, if they had a lower level of antioxidants, they had a reduction of glutathione, which is one of those master antioxidants, that went from 26% to 93% reduction. So that's a significant reduction. It means that our skin is definitely trying to protect itself against the sun. So I am going to have Dr. Pierre call in about 5 minutes. I had so much more I wanted to go over regarding sun. I'm going to specifically go into the prickly pear cactus. So the prickly pear cactus is a cactus that grows in Arizona, and its pulp is really good for combating sunburn. So in traditional Western herbalism, we'll often take the spikes off of the prickly pear, I guess it's a pad. So we'll take the spikes off of the pad, and then we'll cut it in half and apply the pulp to our skin, directly to our skin. So it's like a pad of cactus sitting on your skin. And it's been touted for its ability to heal sunburn rapidly. So when I lived out in Arizona, my husband, who's very fair-skinned, didn't wear a hat when we went on a long hike, and he got some significant sunburn. He was really uncomfortable. So one day I came home from school, and I saw him sitting there at his computer with prickly pear cactus all over his head. And he had been sitting like that for about 3 hours. And when he removed the prickly pear, the areas where the prickly pear had been were completely back to normal. But the areas where prickly pear didn't overlap, so there were small fissures that were still burnt. So that really spoke to how well prickly pear works. And I believe it's because of the high antioxidant levels that you find in prickly pear. And it makes sense that these fruits and plants that grow in hot environments would have high levels of antioxidants to overcome sun damage, because just as our skin is affected by the sun's rays, so are plants. The final thing I want to talk about is chlorine. So we're probably spending a lot of time, you know, once it gets warmer, we're probably going to be spending a lot of time out in swimming pools. And chlorine is a chemical that's used to disinfect swimming pools. It turns out, though, that chlorine can have a lot of health effects on people, especially when substances that are on our skin, like sweat, lotions, when those substances interact with chlorine, they can produce toxins that can be very hazardous for us to be exposed to. Chlorine itself can cause red and swollen eyes, dried skin, nasal congestion. The substances that are produced, like chloramine, that's produced as a result of nitrogen-rich substances that we find naturally on human skin. When it interacts with chlorine, it produces chloramine. And chloramine actually has a lot of chemical effects that can lead to DNA damage and oxidative stress. So what I usually recommend is that people shower before they get into the pool so they can get a lot of those organic compounds off of their skin before they get in the pool. Substances like vitamin C and taurine, which is an amino acid, taurine can help our bodies detoxify the chlorine that we're being exposed to, because chlorine will be absorbed through our skin and circulate through our bloodstream, and our liver is what really filters a lot of these toxins. So taurine can bind to the chlorine and help it flush out of our bodies. And the vitamin C is antioxidant support to help with neutralizing the effects of chlorine. So the final thing I wanted to say is that, again, the information in this show is purely for educational purposes. If you want to implement anything, please discuss it with your doctor. Always follow proper protocol with young children who are more prone to being burned. So definitely keep them in the shade and protect them from the sun. The burns for younger kids can actually be life-threatening because they're so small that they can lose a lot of water as a result and have difficulty recovering. So with all that said, I am going to ask Dr. Jennifer Pierre to call in, and I wanted to go over her bio really quickly. So Dr. Pierre and I work together, and we went to the same school together down in Arizona. And before medical school, she has had over a decade of experience as a public health professional, including roles in research and public health infrastructure and development, prenatal health education, mental health counseling. She is amazing at practicing naturopathic medicine because she'd been doing it for decades before she became an ND. She's very involved in global health initiatives. She'd been involved in medical missions in Haiti and Mexico and Kenya. And she also received certification in prenatal and Kundalini yoga. So she specializes in chronic diseases such as autoimmune disease, the effect of stress and anxiety. And her practice style, she describes herself as warm and honest, using holistic and functional medicine along with acupuncture, which I would have to agree, she's very warm and honest. So do we have Jennifer on the line? Hi, Jennifer.
Hi.
So Dr. Pierre, would you like to share some summertime tips with our listener base?
Oh, sure. First, I want to say thank you for having me on your show this morning. I've been listening in with the speakers, with the audience about everything you've been talking about. And I think it's been wonderful. So I wanted to talk about just some tips as far as when you're traveling, how to seek out good, healthy food options. It seems in the summertime, there's a lot more treats and snacks. And so you can become susceptible to not eating as healthy because there's so many desserts and so many options that may not be as healthy for us. So one of my biggest tips is to use Yelp. There are many apps online that have ways to search out healthy food, and I use Yelp. I'm a Yelper. And if you just search vegetarian options or healthy options, salad bars, smoothie, little smoothie houses and things like that, you'll find some healthy options in anywhere you're traveling, particularly if you're in an area that has a lot of good agriculture and good weather. So that would be usually in the warmer areas of the country. Also, seeking out farmers markets would be helpful. Usually on the weekends, there are a lot of farmers markets that are available, so you can seek out food there. There's another app that I've used called Happy Cow, and that has vegetarian options to look out for. And also what would be helpful is researching places to eat before you travel. So certain rest stops have sometimes little Asian eateries, and I find that ethnic food places tend to be the easiest to find healthier options. So those are just a few things. I don't know if you had some more thoughts about that you wanted me to talk about.
Yeah, no, those sound like great tidbits. Thank you so much for sharing. And for all the listeners, Dr. Pierre is going to be hosting next month's radio show, so you'll be able to learn so much more from her next month. Thank you so much for calling in, Dr. Pierre.
Oh, yeah, no problem. I'm excited to be here.
All right, bye.
Bye.
So those were great tidbits. I find that it can be hard. I often daydream about having kitchens available on the sides of roads where people can just show up and make their own homemade meals, especially when they're road tripping, because that seems to be a time where we are reliant on eating out. Another thing that can be helpful is if you're traveling, taking probiotics with you, especially if you're prone to developing gut infections or food poisoning. So probiotics, if you take them, they seem to help boost our immune system and help reduce the likelihood of developing food poisoning. And they can also help people who have irritable bowel syndrome with digesting foods that may not agree with them, which if you've ever struggled with IBS, you know, I'm sure you've experienced the inability to know how you'll react to any given food at any time. And so probiotics can help when you're traveling and you don't really have control over the types of foods that you're eating. Lately, what I've been seeing a lot of is a condition called orthorexia, where people are so preoccupied with their health and what they're eating that it consumes their life. And after they've had one meal, they're already planning the next meal. And there's often a lot of micromanaging of their diets and eliminating huge food groups from the diets. Now, I think that it is important if people are noticing that their symptoms get worse related to eliminating certain foods. But in general, what I tend to recommend, especially when people are on vacation, is moderation. So focusing on clean eating maybe one or two times a day. So as Dr. Pierre recommended, finding salad bars or smoothie places or ethnic food restaurants. For example, Jamaican food and Indian food, those are two of my go-tos for healthy eating because they tend to have foods with a lot of antioxidant spices and vegetable options. But enjoy that one meal that may not be healthy for you if you often eat healthy, because it's impossible to multitask your life to the degree where every meal is healthy, and it may actually not be healthy to do that. Some of the other things I wanted to bring up, we have about 3 minutes left, is ticks. So it's so important to do regular tick checks, especially since we're in tick season and the larvae, which are the smallest ticks, the youngest ticks, are out right now. And they're so tiny that they may just look like a tiny mole on your skin. But those ticks can also carry infections and transmit Lyme disease and the Lyme co-infections. And the problem with Lyme is oftentimes we rely on full-blown Lyme disease, which causes fever, chills, joint pains, to signal that somebody needs to get tested for Lyme. The bullseye rash is usually the most clear symptom of somebody having Lyme disease, but only a really small percentage of the population will develop those full-blown symptoms when they have Lyme. So I think it's important to do regular tick checks on yourself, on your kids. Know your kids' skin. Know what's normal. Know what isn't. Because even the smallest tick can cause a Lyme infection. And Lyme can be difficult to diagnose through lab testing because it takes a couple of weeks for some people to develop antibodies that are detected to diagnose it. For some, it can even take months of being infected before antibodies are produced. So what I usually recommend is saving that tick. So save it in a container, mail it out. So there's a lot of labs that will actually test a tick to see what kinds of bacteria were growing in it. And that will give you an idea of what types of infections you need to keep an eye on. Outside of Lyme disease, there's Babesia, Bartonella, Ehrlichia. There's a lot of different types of bacteria that can be transmitted through ticks. So if you look online, you will find a host of labs that are able to have you mail in your tick and get it tested. That is if you find a tick burrowed into yourself or a loved one. So thank you so much for tuning in. I'm Dr. Verdi. You are listening to Seeking Wellness Radio, Our Bodies Explained. Next month, Dr. Pierre will be hosting the show on the fourth Saturday of the month from 9 to 10 a.m. And you'll be hearing from me again in August, hoping that you have a good summer and our weather gets warm.